My name is Carol Wadeen, and this week I'm doing some discussions on the historical perspective of art. And this is the second of three discussion groups. And today we're going to be looking at the symbolism in Christian art. Yesterday I started with slides of early Christian images, and this was at the catacombs, and we went up to about the 15th century. So today I'm going to start with the 15th century and go on, but I'm going to be emphasizing the images. And I want us to go slowly, and anytime you have any questions, let's spend more time today. We don't have so many hundreds of years to cover. So let's spend more time on each slide if you like, and be sure to discuss the various aspects of each slide. And I'll try today to be sure to give the name of the artist, because by the time we get to the 15th century, we usually know the artist's name. That isn't always true with some of our earlier images. And I'll also tell you the century and what country that the work was done. But before I begin, I want to give you a definition of symbolism. And the book, I work with several books. I only brought one with me, and I particularly like this one because even it is the smallest, but it's the easiest to work with, because rather than putting all the symbols together in a big dictionary form, as my other book on symbolism is, this one works with the animal symbols, the flower symbols, the clothing, and so forth. So it's sort of in categories, and I just find it a little easier to handle, you know. Besides, it's paperback and it's small, and I could carry it with me easily. But this book is available in most of your bookstores, if they have any sections on art books, so you wouldn't have a problem finding it. And it's really excellent. If you plan on traveling, like traveling to Europe, where you would be seeing so much of the Christian art, it would be a wonderful book to take along. And it's called Signs and Symbols in Christian Art, and it's by George Ferguson. And it also has in here 300 black and white illustrations. So as it's talking about something, you know, you can check it out. Well, I like the definition for symbolism in here so well that I'm just going to go ahead and read a couple of these paragraphs. And then let's just take time afterwards to see if some of you have specific experiences where a symbol has meant so much that you don't have words to explain it. You know, and I think we all have had those experiences. Words can hardly do what that symbol has done for us. The Christian asserts that man is created in the image of God. He declares that God has given man a soul capable of reaching up into heaven itself and inspiring the human mind to its noblest achievement, the quest after God. It is this spiritual aspiration that lifts man to its highest and greatest heights. No words have ever been found that are adequate to give it satisfactory expression. There is a reason for this. God has given the soul the privilege of enjoying a continuous awareness of the realities of life. These realities may be described as the never-ending experiences man has with truth, beauty, and goodness. These experiences are so vital and so moving that man has a constant urge to impart them to others. It is in this act of sharing them that he gives witness to the truth that he is indeed made in the image of God. There is a language for these experiences. It is a very simple and beautiful language which man has known and used since the beginning of time. It is called the language of the sign and the symbol, an outward and visible form through which is revealed the inward and invisible reality that moves and directs the souls of men. Let us take one simple example. Are there any words that truly express human love? Yet the touch of a hand, the light of an eye, the radiance of a face, These symbols of love are far more expressive than any words. Or sorrow. How can its depth be made known? A single tear coursing down the cheek reveals what words can never express. Then again, goodness. Can anyone adequately describe it? Of course not. We know it is an act, or a hundred acts, a bent of the soul that has ruled a mind to think and a body to labor in kindness and gentleness and in sacrifice of self and in service of others. These are symbols that men have always understood. There are no words for them because the experiences of the soul with life's deepest realities are made known through them. They are truly in a universal language. These signs and symbols are the language of the soul. So before we begin to look at our slides today, would any of you like to share experiences that you've had that were very, very moving symbolic experiences? Yes.
I think the most beautiful one I saw was in Italy. That's not a picture, but anyway, it was so beautifully set up. The lighting fixtures in a half oval setting. And I noticed other people there just had tears running down. It's very...
What was it, a sculpture? Was it the sculpture of David?
David, yes.
Yes, okay. And so then just the type of lighting and so forth. Yes, of course. It is.
In Florence, Firenze, they had some beautiful paintings up there. It's an outdoor place in a park. And I would love to have bought at least a couple of them. But when you're traveling, you got a suitcase, you can't send them home. I thought, what am I going to do? How will I manage it, you know? But they're so well done and so beautiful. Mm-hmm. And they're so inexpensive, which is more of a, makes you feel like, gee, I wish I could get that.
Have any of you others experienced? Oh, I know you have. I was just telling Dee this morning, Doe this morning, we were talking about grandchildren, and I have 100 I could share with you, but then we wouldn't have time for the slides. But this is one I just thought of this morning. And it symbolizes love, I think. I have a little 5-year-old grandchild, and he had been wanting to stay overnight, and he had never stayed overnight at Grandma's house. And he had been wanting to for several weeks, and he knew that it was coming up. And because his 8-year-old brother had done it a month earlier. And he had packed his little suitcase several times, and he had to unpack it because it wasn't the time yet. So the day I came to get him, I could hear him running through the house when I knocked on the door. And when I opened the door, he hugged my leg so hard. I really didn't think a 5-year-old could, you know, that he might almost break my bones. They were hugged so hard. And, you know, that was a real symbol of love. Yeah. It wasn't a visual symbol, but I surely felt it. Well, would any of the others like to share something before we begin?
I have a very different type of symbolic experience. I don't know how you really classify it. This was friends of mine. It was summertime. And we were in a dry part of California on some land that they owned, and there was this great big pile of brush, and they'd been clearing this, and it was the home site where they were going to build their home. And rising up out of this pile of brush were two full-grown rattlesnakes. And they entwined like the caduceus. And we killed them, and actually somebody, and we were having a barbecue, And they did eat a portion of them because it was as though it was a sacrifice on their whole side.
For their land.
And who was it? Rattlesnakes.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
We think they were mating. We think that's actually what was happening. But there was the symbolism, which is just incredible.
Well, I know that we have one gentleman with us that is American Native, right? Indian, right? And their symbolism, of course, is all around their religious beliefs. And so I hope you will share with us some of your symbolism as we go through the discussion. Okay, so why don't we turn on the slides then. I'm going to show you a couple that I left off with yesterday because we had to go through them so quickly at the end, and they happen to have a great deal of symbolism. So there'll be a couple that we saw yesterday, and then we'll go on to the other centuries. This was the middle of a triptych that you saw. It is an Italian triptych. This was the 14th century, and it was done in Florence. Dada, the name of the artist, it is one of the first artists that we have with a name on an art object in our museum. A 14th century, it's pretty difficult to get artists, known artists before that time. I failed to mention yesterday when you saw this triptych, and if you can remember, those of you that were here, it was a three-piece altarpiece that was used on our home or private residence. Dado was so busy at this time making these kinds of triptychs. There was such a demand for them, and he was so famous for them that he actually had to set up an assembly line and bring in other artists to help. That was the first time that we talk about having church and religious items brought into the home. And since Florence was such a wealthy city, there were many wealthy people that could afford this kind of thing. And so we see then the blossoming of art being brought into the private homes. Well, I wanted to show this particular piece because we didn't talk about the symbols very much yesterday of the colors. And we're going to see these used again and again. And I know that you people have seen this so many times and are aware that we usually think of blue as the color for the Virgin Mary. And here we see her blue mantle and the red undergarment. The red is for passion, the passion of the crucifixion, the blood of Christ, and then the blue signifies heaven. And of course, these are the colors that we will see traditionally used with her. I also want to point out the gold halo on both the Christ child as well as Mary, and there is a lot of gold in the background of this triptych also. Right here we're seeing the red of the back of her throne, but behind all of this was gold. And this is actually gold leaf, very, very thin gold leaf. So it really, if you have any light coming into the room, it really glistens and glows. And of course, gold symbolizes the sacredness of heaven. And with our Byzantine, and this is the Eastern influence that we're getting here, because Constantinople was the capital when Constantine in the 3rd century, the Emperor of Rome, took on Christianity as his religion. Then, of course, the entire area that was Rome immediately took on Christianity also. And I think sometimes we are so quick to think how bad these Romans were for killing Christ, and we don't think in terms of how the Romans made it possible for the spread of Christianity. We wouldn't have it wouldn't have spread like it did if the emperor didn't take this religion, yes, his religion, and maybe he did it because the Christians were irritating him so much, and if you can't, you know, he couldn't quite get rid of them, they were underground all over, and so if you can't get rid of them, join them, you know, that might have been the philosophy. But think of the Roman roads that went way up into England, all through Europe, way on east, you know, on to Persia and so forth, on down into Africa. So, you know, we had this wonderful road system, and he turned the pagan temples into Christian cathedrals and basilicas. So a lot of money went into it at that point. So it was really spread with the wonderful transportation and system that they had going, the political system. So the capital then was in Constantinople. And this is an Eastern influence, this very flat vision of Mary and Jesus rather than a more full one, and with the gold. And we'll usually see Christ in kind of a more of a standing rather than a sitting position with our icons and our Eastern images. And of course the halos identify dignity. And then we did look at the four evangelists yesterday, but this is a different example than we saw yesterday. This one is 9th century, and it's in Germany. I want to then just remind you that weren't here yesterday, we're looking at Matthew here, and his symbol is the winged man. John, and his is the eagle. Luke, and his symbol is the oxen. And Mark, and his symbol is the winged lion. And we'll see that used over and over and over again. In fact, this morning in Bible study, they talked about it in our Bible study this morning. This is an example of Spanish art of the 17th century, and it's done by El Greco. Tomorrow I will be putting on more images that El Greco has done. He worked in what we call the Manonist style, and we also consider it counter-reformation. Notice it's very, very dramatic. What we're seeing here is St. Peter, and what I wanted to show you today is the symbol of St. Peter, and you'll usually see St. Peter holding the keys to heaven.
The keys to what?
The keys to heaven.
Oh.
This is a painting by Titian, and again, another Italian painter, very, very well-known painter in the 16th century. And I'm showing you here a picture of Mary Magdalene. Now we know Mary Magdalene was a penitent sinner, and she's often represented in art with flowing hair. I wish she doesn't have her hair quite, you know, under her veil and so forth, or under her mantle. Kind of images that we think of a prostitute today. Very, very often, her top garment, her blousey effect of her top garment, will be draping down over a shoulder. Usually it's not revealing a breast. But you watch when you see Mary Magdalene's images from now on, and that is usually the case. Very flowing hair and just almost losing her garment off her shoulder. Well, there are many artists that have carried it just a little bit further, and Titian was one. And we can see here Mary Magdalene with her bare breasts and her long flowing hair around her breast, a very sensuous image. Mary Magdalene is also usually seen at the crucifixion. The three people that we will normally see at the crucifixion scene are Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and John, the apostle, or the evangelist. And those are the three that you will almost always see at a crucifixion scene. Any questions about Mary? She's gotten a rough rap from our artists over the centuries.
Are you going to show a picture of the three of them together?
Probably, I just can't recall now, but I'm sure, yes, I will. Mm-hmm. In just a minute. This is a very, very favorite Christmas card. It's one of the most Fra Angelico, who was, again, an Italian artist, worked in northern Italy in the 14th century. His work is the most copied work at Christmas time of any artist we have. And he's beginning to use figures, if you remember the first one I showed you, the Byzantine Madonna, where it was quite flat. Fra Angelico's began to have more lifelike reality to the human beings as well as the animals. You know, he's really studying them. The people really look like real people. And if this one is at the museum, and I know several of the people here come to our museum often, and the next time you come, it's a very small little painting, just about like so. And it's in the gold room with these other medieval paintings. If you study it closely, you can see every hair on Joseph's beard. You can see gold threads in Mary's red garment. It's just absolutely beautiful.
When was this done?
This was done in the 14th century. Still very early. It's one of our first examples of landscape. See, notice the background, we still have the gold sky, and that would be actual gold leaf. But we have a hint of landscape coming now. And these are the shepherds up here, and you see they're just really fearful because of the news they're getting. And a little tree, so we're just beginning to get a little shape of landscape. Now, obviously, this is not the kind of a stable that we have oftentimes seen. The artist has fabricated this to make a setting for his nativity scene. He's just got this stable right out here in the pasture. But he's, by doing it that way, manipulating it, he can get the various symbols in he wants. So what I'd like to talk about is the actual nativity scene here. Well, first of all, we have a baby that really looks like a baby for the first time, haven't we? Well, we've seen lots of images of baby Jesus, but he hasn't looked like a real baby. And the artist has painted him in the nude, and he's given him every single human part of the body. So you're sure to know that that is indeed a little boy baby. And you take note the next time you go in the museum. It's very, very exacting. We see the straw here looking like it's gold. And of course the halo again on both Mary and Joseph. Not only does Mary have her red and very, very beautiful fabric with gold thread in robe, but Joseph also has the red and blue, and normally this would not be true for Joseph. Another symbolism here that you will almost always see with the nativity scene are the animals, and we'll see the oxen and the donkey, and that is because we consider them to be two of the lowliest animals, and so they symbolize humility, and in this case they're even kneeling to the Christ child. We also see some lovely little angels up here with halos, and of course they're in that blue color that signifies heaven.
How's that perspective there? Yeah.
Well, we're just beginning to get perspective, Walt. You know, you have a little feeling of the hill going back here, and there's some shading here, but there isn't much yet. I'll show you some in just a couple of centuries later where there's a tremendous amount of perspective. It's just beginning. In 100 years, they'll have mastered it. Another question?
Right alongside the leg of the donkey, there's more red there. Is that part of the garment? There?
Yes, this is, well, because Joseph's garment is red on the outside and blue on the inside. And it's just the way it's folded.
Oh, okay. That's
And, of course, very rich gold all around it. Not the story that we usually hear of Mary and Joseph's clothing.
I heard that his family is quite wealthy. They were traders, you know, on the sea.
Uh-huh. Well, usually the artists take the liberty to depict what they want to, and that's part of art.
I just walked in. What year was that?
This is 14th century Italy. Oh. It's Fra Angelico is the artist.
Right.
And I think you've seen his work on Christmas cards.
Right.
He was a very, very, did just a tremendous amount of painting. Mm-hmm. Now we're seeing an Annunciation piece, and this is 15th century, and it's Flemish. It is filled with symbolism. But before we talk about the specific symbols, I want to ask if, well, rather than ask, I'll go ahead at this point and tell you. This is a household scene that would be an upper middle income family living in Holland or in that area of Northern Europe. So the Annunciation scene isn't quite in context with the Bible time. But of course they're doing this so that the people where this altarpiece, and again it is a triptych and it's going to be used as an altarpiece, it's a large piece, and it will be used in a church. And it's so that the worshipers could really identify with it. It's painted as it would be for their households, for the people that are worshiping in that congregation, with the very types of artifacts that they would have in their own house. I'm going to be talking mostly about this center panel, and I have some close-up slides that can show it to you better than what we're seeing here. But before we go to the close-ups, I want to talk about the two outer panels because they're kind of interesting. This one over here is Joseph. And he's shown in his carpenter shop with all of his carpenter tools. And guess what he's making? He's making a mousetrap. Mm-hmm. Now, isn't that pretty symbolic? I mean, Christ is being, they're announcing that Christ is going to be born here, or Gabriel's going to be telling Mary that she's going to be becoming the mother of Christ, and Joseph is making a mousetrap. So, setting up Christ for his dad. Crucifixion is that ending. On this panel over here are the donors. And we had mentioned last time we met that the donors, the people who commission the work, are usually wealthy people that can afford to give a nice gift like this to the church. And they like to have their pictures included. And we all know of people that add a wing on a building, but you know, they'll add the wing if their name can be the wing of the building. Well, in those days, this was typical for the donors to want to have their picture on the piece. And so they're dressed in the kind of clothes of Mary, that she is going to be the mother of the Christ child. Usually, in a Annunciation scene, we'll see a lily. Sometimes Gabriel will be carrying it, or else it will be in a vase between Gabriel and Mary. But we'll almost always see a lily. And a lily signifies purity. And we see again Mary here with her symbolic red. She's reading, and almost always in an Annunciation scene, she'll be reading. Now, it's very unlikely that Mary was able to read. But the artists have loved Mary in the, you know, the people loved Mary so much in the medieval times and on through history that they have, you know, they've made her a saint and given her powers that, and the artifacts and so forth that go with it. So you'll very, very often see her reading. And of course he's interrupting her as she's reading. A little closer view. I specifically wanted you to see this Delph vase, a Delph picture. Now, many of us are familiar with this kind of ceramic ware. It's made in the city of Delft in Holland. And it's a favorite kind of thing to bring back as a souvenir when you go to Holland. So they're making it very, very definitely a picture to be used in that country to have meaning to those people. And the candle has always been symbolic in Christianity for many, many reasons. And again, we see the open Bible. This is an example I did use last time, and I wanted to spend a little more time on it today. An altarpiece, a large triptych again, 15th century, Flanders. The city that we're seeing in the background here is Bruges. At that time, it was one of the most largest and wealthiest cities in Northern Europe. And much of its wealth came about because of the weaving industry. And so we see beautiful, beautiful fabrics because they want to show what that city, you know, is able to produce. It's also a city where a lot of the banking is done. So it's a, and this triptych was made for one of the cathedrals in that city. Now this is one time, it's not very often that this happens, but this is one time when they did not dress the three people that we usually see at the crucifixion in their typical clothes that would be the attributes that would tell us that they are Mary, John, and the mother of Jesus. And I think it's because, again, they wanted to show us the time being the 15th century, and they wanted to show us as much as they could of the materials that were being produced in that city at that time. But we of course, know this is Christ. Down here is a little dandelion. And dandelion is the symbol of the bitter herb, and they talk about that in the Bible. Mary is dressed in blue, but she's in a nun's habit rather than her traditional garb. And Mary Magdalene, John the Baptist. And then I mentioned last time too that we think this is Joseph of Arimathea. And that was the Joseph that gave the tomb for the burial of Jesus. He gave his tomb for Jesus to be buried in. And we think that's who it is because of the way he's dressed. He's dressed in very wealthy type of clothing. These are the donors, we believe. This is St. Catherine, and I have a close-up of her, but it doesn't show her sword in the close-up, and I want you to see that, and that is one of her attributes. We'll usually see her with the sword of being a martyr. And over here is John the Baptist, and under his red outer garment here is the camel hair. And that goes back to our biblical stories that we usually see John the Baptist in the desert or in the wild desert areas with camel hair. That goes back to your biblical stories. And I think we see here a thistle, and that is a symbol of sorrow. And of course his bare feet. I wanted to show you a close-up of how beautiful St. Catherine is, and she was known for her beauty. St. Catherine was born in Alexandria of Egypt, and she wasn't Christian when she was born, but she did take on the Christian religion. And the story is that one of the ruling people in that, she was born to a noble family, so she didn't know how to read. And we will usually see her holding a book because she had great knowledge. But because of her great beauty, there was a leader in the country that wanted to marry her, and he was Christian, and she refused her marriage to him, and she was killed. He had her killed. We also see her with a crown. And a crown of nobility, and with beautiful, beautiful jewels.
Yes. Her hair looks almost like peacock feathers. Is there any relationship to the peacock as a symbol?
No, there isn't, as to my. But it's very definitely a Flemish color here. I don't think it is what St. Catherine had if she was born in northern Africa, do you?
No.
So I'm glad you pointed that out, or mentioned her hair. You know, it's that Flemish red.
Mm-hmm. We're just Catholic.
What you're seeing probably is that she has ermine on, you see? And so maybe that gives you the feeling of the feathers, well, and the eyes of the feather. That's ermine lining her outer garment. Another question?
I just wondered where Catherine lived.
Where did she live?
Yes.
In Alexandria, in Egypt. In what century? About the second century, I believe. Maybe some of you know that history. I could look it up. Let's look it up afterwards. I've got the story right in here.
Oh, okay.
We'll look it up. This is a good one to notice how these northern artists really, really studied nature. Look at every leaf. And I think I showed you, I didn't show you the close-up of that. I just wanted to emphasize the feet.
Is there any significance in that daisy?
It is. I thought it was a thistle when I was looking at it, because we do have some of his with thistles. Don't you think this might be a dandelion? Mm-hmm. This white right here is the dandelion part that's gone to seed.
Yes.
And the dandelion, of course, is a bitter herb. And so he goes to a pretty sad death, too. Back here we see, I think, an enemy. And that is also, and this goes back to pagan times, and that is shown with sorrow. Another example of John the Baptist, this is El Greco. This would be done in Spain in the 16th century. And El Greco's noted for having very moody, dark, the skins of his people almost look kind of like they're sick. And extremely emotional. We see several other symbols that are sometimes used with John the Baptist here. Of course, again, now we see the camel here, but the lamb, and I think most of us when we think of John, do think of oftentimes he carries a lamb. And this is the reed cross. It is reed because of the symbolism of John with baptism in water. We have this example at the Minneapolis Institute of Art, and I did show it last time, but we didn't get a chance to talk about it too much, and it's absolutely filled with symbolism. It's called Madonna and Child in the Landscape, and it's 15th century Brussels. First, I want you to notice the size of Madonna. I mean, if she stood up, she would be 8 feet tall. She's really, really a big, big lady here. So they're trying to emphasize here the importance, you know, her importance and her dominating place in the landscape. The landscape itself is symbolic of the Garden of Paradise, and she's sitting in a grassy ledge there in the landscape. She's dressed with her symbolic colors of red for passion. We see just a tint of blue here. Christ is dressed in white, and of course that is for purity. The iris that we're seeing all around the village right now, and some right here in our centerpiece, is the name iris comes from, it means the sword lily. So of course that is a symbol of sorrow. The peacock, I've got a close example to show you of that, is used very often, sometimes even at the nativity scene, and it's for immortality because they believe that the flesh of the peacock never deteriorates after death. It's an old pagan myth. I want to just have you see the beautiful detail, and also here the lovely flowers. I believe this would be an anemone, isn't it? Would that be what it would be called? And there are some lovely little violets. They don't show here. Let's go back because I wanted to be sure to mention the violet.
It's over up there, looks like.
Pardon? That's the close-up of the blue iris, and I've told you, well, here's the little blue violets, right here. The blue violets are for humility because they grow so low to the ground. And we'll see that oftentimes.
So you've got forget-me-nots.
Yes, and I don't have any story about the forget-me-nots. I'll check that out, though, afterwards and see if there is some. But aren't these beautiful blue iris? The artists in Northern Europe were just, their landscapes and their foliage were absolutely gorgeous. The peacock. And the stags in the background here, they stand for piety and religious aspiration because the stag seeks freedom and refuge in the high mountains. And these stumps, the sawdust tree, they're symbolizing the tree of life as well as the wood or the tree that was used for the Christ's cross. Oh, I just love this one. I think it's so whimsical. It's an Annunciation, and it's in our museum. It is done by an Italian artist in the 16th century. His name was Santa Cruz. And here we have Archangel Gabriel just flying down. You see the whirl of the fabrics and so forth with his lilies. And Mary's being interrupted from her reading again in her home here now in Italy. And dressed in her usual colors. and he's, you know, announcing. Well, we all know what the message is, because God, the Heavenly Father up here, is not only sending down the dove, the Holy Spirit, but he's got this little bomb baby coming right down too, so we sure know what the story is. We call this our bomb baby picture. Now, we haven't seen many pictures of God. I haven't shown you that. You know, the first 1500 years, we didn't see God. I'm going to show you, when we go into the 15th, 16th, and 17th centuries, we see a lot of heaven, and we'll see a lot of pictures of God.
Are they trying to show the outside with those window kind of?
Oh, yes. Again, the artist is taking all kinds of liberties here. And we're getting, you know, the artists by now know how to do perspective, and they want to show their skills. And so that's what we're getting here with this. It's a doorway. And so you're able to see through the doorway there. And then here's another doorway that's going back to another room in the house. It looks like possibly two nuns back there.
When was that done?
This was done in 16th century.
Because some of the reading I had done, I don't know if I told you that, in the Middle Ages, they actually thought that the sperm of the man was in the shape of was actually a small body, and was that the woman carried it, and actually, in other words, it wasn't a union of egg and sperm cell.
The woman,
but here, so in other words, here the Holy Spirit is putting
the whole little body.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, in the Middle Ages, that is true, I think, and I know you know more about that, Walt, than I do, but if you go back to Aristotle, I believe, he thought that the woman, she was just an incubator. You know, the man, the man had it all, and the woman has been pretty much, during the Middle Ages, not seen on a very high status. But we're getting beyond that now in the 16th century, 16th, 17th century. Women have a higher position in society.
Well, if there were the case in the Union, and if a couple were childless, how could they explain that? Because it's a man, you know, they didn't want to accept the fact of a man being impotent, so far.
No.
I never heard that before.
No, I was reading. In fact, I'll find that book. It's in there. It's about, it had to do with symbolism, not symbolism, but some of the ancient fertility rites and stuff. And I was just flabbergasted.
But you know, they've always, it was their idea, if there were no children, it was a woman's fault.
You
know, women.
But in a case like this, they could blame it on to
This is Dürer, and he's a German, and we're in the 16th century now. It's a woodcut, so it's a different medium of art than we've seen before. He did wonderful, wonderful woodcuts, and I know most of you are familiar with his work. I put this in just to show you the Trinity. We haven't had symbols of God before. We haven't had very many of the Holy Spirit, and here we see God, the Holy Spirit, and Christ, and God wearing the mitre hat, or the hat of the Pope, authority. Dürer always signs his initials like this, someplace on all of his paintings and of all of his woodcut work. That large A with the D, and it was done in 1511. So his work is well documented. Let's see if I've got these. I took one out this afternoon, and maybe I... Oh, well,
The bag?
Yep. No.
I'll go back.
Okay, we'll go back here. I'll just briefly show you this, and then we'll do the next one. I had one that had a tremendous amount of symbolism, and when I was making sure I understood all the symbolism in this, I must have left it on my desk. And if we continue with this tomorrow, I'll slip it in because it's very, very good. This is St. Francis. And we see several symbols of him here. We did in the one before this too, and that was the one I mostly wanted to talk about. But this habit that is symbolic. But notice the tie the rope that he uses for his belt. There are three knots here, and they're the two different symbols here. One is Trinity, and one is the three vows that he's taken. And chastity, poverty, and all of this written down, maybe somebody can...
Obedience,
okay. But I want to now stop here for just a minute, and I want to read you, because we just have time probably for one more, I want to read you the story of Nebuchadnezzar out of Daniel, and then we'll look at an example of what William Blake, an 18th century English artist, did of Nebuchadnezzar. So I'm looking here at Daniel chapter 4. This is the dream I had, said King Nebuchadnezzar. Now, Belshazzar, tell me what it means. None of my royal advisors could tell me, but you can, because the spirit of the holy gods is in you. At this time, Daniel, who is also called and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, Belshazzar, was so alarmed that he could not say anything. The king said to him, don't let the dream and its message alarm you. He replied, Your Majesty, I wish that dream and its explanation applied to your enemies and not to you. The tree so tall that it reached the sky could be seen by everyone in the world. Its leaves were beautiful, and it had enough fruit on it to feed the whole world. Wild animals rested under it, and birds made their nests in their branches. Your Majesty, you are the tree, tall and strong. You have grown so great that you reach the sky, and your power extends over the whole world. While Your Majesty was watching, an angel came down from heaven and said, Cut the tree down and destroy it, but leave the stump in the ground. Wrap a band of iron and bronze around it, and leave it there in the field with the grass. Let the dew fall on this man, and let him live there with animals for 7 years. This, then, is what it means. Your Majesty, and this is what the Supreme God has declared will happen to you, you will be driven away from human society, and will live with wild animals. For 7 years you will eat grass like an ox and sleep in the open air where the dew will fall on you. Then you will admit that the Supreme God controls all human kingdoms and that he can give them to anyone he chooses. The angels ordered the stump to be left in the ground. This means that you will become king again when you acknowledge that God rules all the world. So then, Your Majesty, follow my advice. Stop sinning, do what is right, and be merciful to the poor. Then you will continue to be prosperous. All this did happen to King Nebuchadnezzar. Only 12 months later, when he was walking along the roof of his royal palace in Babylon, he said, Look how great Babylon is. I built it as my capital city to display my power and my might and my glory and my justice and my majesty. Before the words were out of his mouth, a voice spoke from heaven. King Nebuchadnezzar, listen to what I say. Your royal power is now taken away from you. You will be driven from human society, live with wild animals, and eat grass like an ox for 7 years. When you acknowledge that the Supreme God has power over human kingdom and that he can give them to anyone he chooses. The words came true immediately. Nebuchadnezzar was driven out of human society and ate grass like an ox. The dew fell on his body, and his hair grew as long as eagle feathers, and his nails as long as the bird's claws. And this is what William Blake, an Englishman then, in the 18th century, depicted Nebuchadnezzar. So, what is your reaction to this? Do you feel sympathy towards him, or that you know, he doesn't deserve any of your compassion at this point?
How are you?
Can you see the hair here as the eagle feathers? And he, you know, does he look more animal or more human to you? It's pretty grotesque, isn't it? But look, the nails on his, well, they said he had bird claws. And here? What ways has the artist depicted the strength of Nebuchadnezzar? I mean, he was a strong man.
Tremendous
muscle structure. That, Walt has indicated to me that we're running out of time, so I think maybe this is a good one to end on. I will continue with these tomorrow, and then I also have illustrations of how art was affected because of the Reformation. And we can do them both in 1 hour. There isn't that much of the Reformation and Counter-Reformation. And it's very, very symbolic, so it lends itself well to follow right along with this. Okay? Well, thank you.
Thank you.